Hello, I'm Mark Bomer, and welcome to another episode of Roadwork. Here's something to think about. A fully loaded super tanker at sea can take as long as 15 minutes and 3 kilometres to come to a full stop and has a turning circle of about 2 kilometres. In many ways, the Australian transport and infrastructure sector is like one of these super tankers. It's a big, powerful behemoth. And if you're trying to affect fundamental change, it takes time and a huge effort to reset the industry's course. There's no better example of this than around the issue of diversity and inclusion. And I think there's no better time to be talking about this issue than right now, when COVID-19 has forced us to rethink how, when, and where we work. So what can and will we take forward from this experience, and how will it impact on the broader D&I agenda long term? To answer these questions, I'm joined today by two champions of change, both of whom are integrally involved in the development and rollout of Roads Australia's diversity and inclusion strategy. Anita De Silva is Managing Director Government ANZ at Oricon, as well as an RA board member and a strong voice for D&I across this industry. Our second guest is Katrina Parker, who is the CEO of human resources consultancy, A Human Agency, and the newly appointed Deputy Chair of our Diversity and Inclusion Committee. So welcome, Anita, and welcome, Katrina. Before we get started, I want to introduce my co-host for today, who is pushing and pulling the levers for our D&I committee behind the scenes, and that's Marley Curtis, our National Membership and Event Manager. So Marley, let's set the scene. Give me a potted history of RA's response in the D&I space.
Look, thanks so much, Mark. Roads Australia has been focusing on diversity for more than 3 years now. We have been proud to establish diversity as a priority across all areas of business, including the way that we engage with members, who we represent as an association, and how we deliver our policy and event program. So over the past 3 years, we have made some great progress. We have a fivefold increase in female speakers on our program. We have doubled the female representation at board lunches. We've held over 25 leadership and mentoring events nationally for emerging leaders, as well as established a greater gender balance across our fellowship mentoring program. We have offered over 50 parental leave seats to keep women in particular engaged in the industry. We've connected members to career seeker participants, resulting in 94 internships across 17 member companies. And we have also hosted a number of diversity-specific events and partnered with the industry to advance social procurement and Indigenous engagement, as well as promoting careers in STEM. We have also, excitingly enough, just appointed our new D&I committee, who will help review our strategy and action plan for the next few years. The strategy focuses on 4 main areas, which is engaging and retaining women, which is obviously our focus for today's podcast, promoting social enterprise programs, supporting Indigenous engagement, and fostering young talent. Our vision is really to achieve broad participation in current and future generations, which we really look forward to sharing with our members soon.
Thanks, Marley. It's great to see that we're really starting to get active in this area now. But look, let's rewind this whole issue and go back to basics. I'd like to put to our guests today the question, why does D&I matter? Let's start with you, Anita.
Thanks, Mark. So it's interesting that we are still in a position where we're still having a conversation around why D&I actually is relevant and why it actually matters for the sector. And over the last 20 years, I've seen that issue talked about in hushed tones behind closed doors. Things have improved dramatically because it's now out in the open. But the fact of the matter is there's still continuing confusion about whether it's a tick-the-box compliance problem, whether it's about the perception of fairness, treating women equally. But against that backdrop, what's surprising to me is it actually is a business imperative. Having a diverse workforce and having an inclusive workforce is key for any company who's trying to maximize its workforce participation, its ability to attract talent, and importantly, its ability to actually innovate. And for me, that becomes even more important in the post-COVID world for our sector, because so many businesses and so many operating models in the infrastructure sector are being disrupted by the COVID pandemic. And if we are not able to access the full suite of talent, not defined by gender, but by capacity, skills, experience, and expertise, then we're really doing ourselves a disservice in the industry.
Yes, indeed. I mean, capacity is such a critical issue at the moment, and we have the solution staring ourselves in the face. Katrina, would you have a comment on that?
Yeah, look, just building on what Anitha said, too often we hear the words D&I, and I think most people's brains do click over to a sort of compliance thinking, and, you know, it's about a program or it's about a report or it's about a target. This is about people. It is fundamentally just about people. And, you know, if we get one big lesson out of a crisis such as this one, a health crisis, it's that you cannot take people for granted. You know, we have a crisis that's impacted us sort of at a very human level, and it impacts business as well. So, you know, you impact people, you impact business. The two are interrelated. So why is D&I important? Because it's about saying who is working, who is in companies, do we have a supply of talent from all over our country? Are we harnessing the very best of our biggest natural resource, which is actually our talent? And are we doing it in a way that will enable us to continue working successfully for generations to come? And a health crisis just shows that we cannot take that for granted, that we will have an endless supply of people. It's not a mineral that we dig out of the ground. It's actually the talent that we cultivate and educate on a daily basis in our schools and in our workplaces. And businesses need to think about it like that. We don't cut these numbers for the sake of it. We actually cut these numbers to double check whether we are scooping the biggest, broadest talent pool possible and then applying all of that talent and ingenuity to delivering on our business strategies. That's D&I for me. It's not about a report at the end of the day.
Why is it that we're still, I guess, dragging some businesses kicking and screaming to the table?
It's interesting you ask that, Mark, because Anitha and I had the great opportunity to both chair a discussion at the International Women's Day Roundtable, and that was on early March. It was probably, we've all said, one of the last events that we actually were physically at. And when we were speaking there, we talked about, you know, what's holding us back, why are we still talking about it? And the thing that everybody named that really stood out for me was that traditional mindsets were alive and well and embedded in all sorts of processes and things we do and the way we do them and why we like to do them like that. And no matter how much awareness and training and business case discussion we'd had up until that point, they were really deeply embedded. Of course, there's a lot of early movers who have started doing great things and aren't representative of that. But those traditional mindsets were alive and well. That's why we were still talking about it. And where I think we go now is, how much have we disrupted those?
I think there's a generation of leadership sitting back and saying, well, it's going to look after itself as the young generation of leaders come through, but we really can't afford to wait for that to happen. It has to happen right now.
Yes. So, Mark, the pressure to actually access all the talent in the workforce is acute. And anyone who's in the sector knows that pre-COVID, we were having multiple conversations, engagements between government and the private sector to work out what is the right way to actually resolve the capacity constraints in the sector, because we have an infrastructure backlog, we have a very significant transport project pipeline in the major capital cities in Australia, as well as the regional centres. Who's going to actually have the resources to apply to delivering that pipeline of work? That was the pre-COVID, one of the top three topics and challenges facing the sector. Post-COVID, I feel that the issue has become, in some way, it's been kind of brought to a head, because there were many structural impediments that really distorted some of the discussions around the access to talent, around the ability to actually really unleash both men and women who required familial support as a collective to be able to really increase their productivity and participation in the sector. So, you know, it's not just a female issue, it's a household issue. Women need supportive men to be able to participate in the infrastructure sector. And many men are constrained by the fact that they don't have a household where their spouse is able to work flexibly, for example. That's just, you know, dumb, frankly, for our transport sector. So post-COVID, I think one of the great things, and this really came out of the second session that we had, which was via one of the webinar platforms that Roads Australia ran, and it was really exciting to see in excess of 40 women give up an hour and a half of their time to engage on the topic of flexibility in this post-COVID work and what it meant for work going forward. So I feel that in some ways, some of the crutches, some of the preconceived views that have held back the advancement, the ability for women in the sector to really engage and contribute, and the ability for men to also do so, has kind of been stripped away. You know, remote working works, there's some constraints, but nothing's perfect. Productivity in many organizations actually has gone up with remote working. So the traditional, you know, presenteeism, which is, I think, one of the things several of the women in that webinar raised, I think the quote was presenteeism is dead. And it's a really potent quote because, you know, we have to basically be more supportive and allow women to basically be able to bring their full potential to the workplace if we want to actually operate and deliver against the infrastructure pipeline that this country is facing.
How then do we embed the flexibility that we've seen explored, and I think explored very successfully over the last 8 weeks? How do we make sure that that now is part of the solution?
I think one of the things I'm already seeing that will assist with this is the exit from offices happened swiftly because we needed to go into lockdown mode, except, of course, for the essential jobs that had to continue on site or, you know, face-to-face where required because of the nature. But in general, anyone who was in a role that could be done from home, it happened with a 1 or 2 week window, quick, swift, get out, get home, get set up. Companies knew what to do, you know, set people up, have a laptop, have internet, keep going. The same will not happen as we re-enter workforces. So we still have a common purpose, which is to keep people safe and keep people working, but the re-entry is going to be highly individualized and tailor-made to the industry you're in, the company you work for, the job you do, the personal preferences of the individual. So it was sort of all out, one size fits all. It is not all back in, one size fits all. And in that moment where we have to consult with people and understand people's individual circumstances, we are now having exactly the conversations and the thought processes that have always been needed to be put in place and adopted to embed flexibility, because we're truly sitting there in a moment going, what does the company need? What does this individual need? What's their job? What's their personal circumstances? And I really think it's this return to, you know, in inverted commas, normal, or the new normal. It's the shaping of the new normal that will embed flex permanently into the way we now do business, because there are businesses that are saying we want it from a business benefits point of view, let alone the employees saying they want it. I mean, I'm already dealing with companies that have made a decision that they will never return to the office 100%. You know, that's already been locked in place. So I think we're seeing the embedding in action as we speak.
So touching on the recent webinars that we've run and the realizations of flexibility, do you think that we have now converted the naysayers, or do you think that things will potentially bounce back to what they were?
So it's an interesting question, because I think as one of the attendees at our webinar very eloquently put in her words, there was now no excuse anymore for having a wholesale embedding of working in an agile and flexible manner. And that's a very potent reflection, because I think, you know, a lot of the naysayers who've pushed back on flexible work practices for families, for women, have put a lot of pressure on those individuals who carry multiple loads. And therefore, they've really struggled unfairly in a pre-COVID world. However, COVID has demonstrated that remote working has not remotely led to a drop-off in productivity. And that has been validated by multiple organizations. I think the other incredibly important part about this is the pandemic forced remote working and a flexible and agile workforce to emerge virtually overnight. So what that demonstrated is the barriers were really artificial. The barriers could be surmounted, and they could be surmounted very quickly. So there's very few organizations. There are one or two, but there are very few organizations who have pushed back on the idea that the future of work is a flexible and agile workforce. That is a huge step forward, in my view.
We have an issue, I guess, around mental health that we're concerned about at the moment as people are working remotely. And part of that is not being part of the team, if you like. How do you reconcile the productivity benefits against the challenges around collaboration and inclusivity?
I think that sits in the point in time where we are now, where what we've done and how we've worked for the last 8 weeks was the immediate response to a crisis. We quickly, you know, got out disaster recovery plans and enacted these ways of working as a temporary measure. But what you're identifying is that as we define what the new normal is, we cannot assume that what we're doing right now will now continue to work as the new normal unchanged. So there are some things that we've done that weren't perfect, but they were perfect in terms of responding to a health crisis. But as we get set up to work like this for the long term, there are things that we cannot take forward into the future. So this lack of boundaries, you know, and this emerged in our recent webinar. I mean, that's one of the things that's leading to a lot of these stresses that you've articulated, Mark, you know, the increasing hyper attentiveness of people, the working all hours, the logging on day and night to check emails. And that's coming from a place of fear. And these are behaviors that has sort of come out of a crisis. But as we say, look at what do we need to take forward and how do we create a new normal way of working. Some of those boundaries have to go back in. So, you know, if you're a part-time worker and you're being paid to work 25 hours, you should be working 25 hours, not 35 hours. If you're a full-time employee, you should now not be suddenly checking emails, you know, 24/7 around the clock from a place of fear or a desire to be continuously connected. So I think this is where we now, to move forward, need to go, what have we learnt? What do we need to change? What do we need to adjust? That worked for then, but it was temporary. I mean, it even goes down to things like, you know, people are working from their kitchen tables because we've got children at home and, you know, multiple generations at home. I mean, even just from a, you know, basic ergonomic setup, that's not appropriate to become the new workplace. Otherwise, we're just pushing a whole bunch of issues down the hill and we'll be getting all the claims in 6 months' time. So, you know, what we do have a responsibility to do now is to really reflect on these lessons of what's working and not working and what do we take forward and bake into the new way of working.
So, Mark, can I just make a few comments on that topic as well? I think that what I'm very heartened by is that there's been quite a bit of a shift towards more of a culture of empathy, I think, to the workforce. So an understanding that basically people have to be treated as individuals. The woman with a family has a particular set of pressures that a flexible, agile work practices would accommodate if allowed. A single younger woman might have a completely different set of pressures and challenges, which again, a flexible, agile workplace built on a culture of empathy is able to basically accommodate. I think the fact that everyone's been stuck at home together for this protracted period of time outside the workforce, in some ways it's been a wonderful experiment in people actually going that extra mile to collaborate with each other and get to know each other beyond the strict parameters of the workplace. And that came out a fair bit with quite a lot of our webinar attendees as well, you know, the sort of refreshing view they had of people that they worked with, because while on a video conference, a child would come, you know, wandering through, or a pet dog would come wandering through, and all of a sudden people are able to see their work colleague as an individual as well as a work colleague. Yeah, I've been so heartened by the virtual drinks that people have basically run to stay connected, to keep that team camaraderie going, the reaching out. So I think those are the positives that, you know, hopefully we'll be able to bake into practices going forward when we come out of this pandemic.
It's great to hear and see all the stories coming out of everyone's team catch-ups and webinars as well. So do you have any advice to employers out there to keep D&I, I guess, in front of mind while everyone's still working at home and to keep everyone connected? I mean, as we've said over and over again, this is a time that we need to be connected more than ever. So I don't know if you can share things that you're doing with your teams to keep everyone connected during this time as well, or to keep diversity and inclusion there and present?
I mean, I think one thing I'd call out straight away is that we really need to be conscious of remembering our youngest workers in the workforce. So there's a lot of focus on how parents are juggling things because we've got multiple caring responsibilities. But the youth are definitely a group that are impacted by this. And I mean, obviously there's focus quite rightly on schooling, but let's even just take our, you know, 1 to 5 year at work employees. They are missing out on some of the really key and essential things that we used to all do in the early days of employment. You know, that opportunity to get quick, you know, on the job training and guidance from a manager, to just ask that question in passing, to go and have drinks at the end of a hard day and build relationships. So some people are absolutely loving being at home, and other people are really missing the workforce because of the other things that it delivers. So we do need to remember that. And if we go back to where we began in the podcast about, you know, why are we doing this? It's because of that supply of talent. And we've lost a lot of young people out of this country. When we lost about 500,000 international students and employees on visas. That is a big drain of our talent pool at a time when we're going to need to restock the pipeline as an industry that wants to grow and deliver on, you know, the economic recovery. So focusing on who works here, where they're going to come from, and our youngest and newest employees, and making sure that they get a really enriching experience, I think is absolutely business critical. And being then mindful of all the other types of experiences. So we have more senior people, we have people with multiple responsibilities, we have people doing a, you know, sort of multi-plate juggling act at the other end of the spectrum. And, you know, as Anita pointed out, we have to become very skilled at thinking about the we and the us, the individual and the company, and balancing the collective and the individual needs. So it's no longer profits or people. The two are going to go hand in hand. And D&I is the way that we actually do that thinking.
Look, we started our conversation by talking about some of the achievements that we within Rhodes Australia have realised over the last 3 years. And Anita, you made the very sound point that we have come a long way in a very short time. But look, it's easy to fall into the trap of saying, well, you know, let's give ourselves a pat on the back. But let's face it, we're starting from a very low base. So in each of your views, what are the markers or measures for change that we need to look for? And how far do you think we are from seeing those put in place?
So I spent a significant part of my career not really a supporter of targets and quotas. And I have to say I've shifted in the last little while. I genuinely feel that the current statistics of females in our sector are humiliating on a global level. And Katrina, you will have sort of greater visibility of that. But, you know, Australia has not come up with a coherent explanation for why it is we have 12% of engineers who are females versus a place like Iran who has 50%. So I think, you know, those are pretty, as I said before, and I mean it, humiliating statistics for us as a first world country put up with. So I feel that we need to have targets at the senior levels of the industry across the transport sector, the construction sector, the engineering sector, the infrastructure sector more broadly. And you can kind of cut the industry however you want. I think that until we actually create layer upon layer of targets all the way down to university intake levels, you know, 1 to 5 years out to the junior ranks of the profession, we're not going to actually be able to get that critical mass of women in the sector. And coming back to what I said at the very beginning of this podcast, that is the way we're actually genuinely going to get a level of diversity and inclusivity in decision-making, in resolving issues, in innovating and creating across the sector. So I feel very strongly, and anything that's widely accepted by Australian Institute of Company Directors, ASX, 30% appears to be the tipping point. But, you know, I come back to if a country like Iran can have 50% of its sector at all levels female, then we've got a lot of soul searching to do, in my view.
Katrina?
Look, I agree. It's tapping into the same sentiment that I'm feeling, which is for something to be a genuine, valid change, it has to become normal. And the reason for that tipping point statistic around 30% is for however long you are in a group of people that is less than 30%, you are in a minority. And that's why that 30% is so powerful. So until we have large enough groups of women in the workforce, Indigenous Australians in the workforce, youth in our workforce, that it is normal to walk down the corridor and see these people happily working and engaged, it feels as though what we're doing is a program rather than this is the normal way of working in this industry, in this country. So we have to do what it takes to get there, or otherwise we are just missing such an enormous opportunity. And like, are we still really honestly able to say that women are a minority group? And we are in this industry. And how can we be a minority group when we're the majority of the country, let alone if you're an Indigenous Australian or youth? You know, we have youth who are coming out of schools, busting to earn a living and build a wonderful career. Where are they? They're not in our pipelines. So until we change that, we are talking about something that is being dealt with in a sort of programmatic way rather than a real, genuine, lived, changed way. And so we have to do the same thing with that thinking as we're hopefully going to do with the flex that comes out of this crisis, which is if flex can be normalised, what else can we normalise? It has to be normal for all these people to work in this industry so we don't need to talk about it anymore.
Indeed.
So just to finalise and wrap everything together, what are the immediate impediments?
What I've observed is there are two immediate challenges that we need to pay attention to, and particularly Rhodes Australia is an organisation that is able to represent its broad membership in the roads and transport sector, has an opportunity to play a role in this space, and that is around the image of the industry. So the image remains, unfortunately, one of a very male-dominated, old-fashioned culture. And that is quite challenging for young people in general, but also young women who, you know, feel that they may not necessarily be supported, may not fit in, and don't really want to put themselves in a position where they're having to deal with old-fashioned discriminatory behavior. Every time there is a negative incident that has an element of aggression associated with it on a construction site or in the sector, there are very strong signals put out to young women. And it has been reflected back to us in Rhodes Australia that that is not very appealing. And who can blame them, right? So the culture, the image has got to shift. I would maintain that for each of those sorts of stories, there are lots of positive stories, but we've got to lead that narrative to really change the public face of the sector if we're genuine about attracting young people and women into the sector. The other critical thing I think is holding us back as an industry is you can't be what you can't see. So we need more female role models in the transport, construction, and infrastructure industry out there being the face, being the examples that younger professionals and younger players can actually aspire to be. It can't be underestimated. That visible success has got to be communicated.
And I'd build on sort of the pipeline of getting people into the industry that Anitha just laid down with the women who are there. We have to work a lot harder to build genuine pathways for career development and career promotion. We know, you know, there is so much solid Australian research into the fact that men have much more access to development and promotion opportunities. And, you know, women are all too often invisible in those conversations. And we should be seeing, as a result of some of the new projects and opportunities coming out of this, more creation of different ways of thinking, new roles, and everybody has to have access to those. So we cannot perpetuate the invisibility of women in those conversations around promotion and career development. And that's the stuff that makes people leave. If you can't see women in the industry, as Anitha said, and if you can't see a way forward, what are you going to do? You're just not going to enter the industry, or you're going to leave and go somewhere where you're valued.
Thanks, Katrina. I think that's a telling point on which to conclude our conversation today. Quite clearly, we've known and understood for a long time that there's a serious workforce imbalance in the Australian transport and infrastructure sector. But it's probably only been in the last 5 to 10 years that there's been a genuine and widespread determination to do something about it. Partly that's been driven by necessity, and going back to my supertanker analogy with which I opened this conversation, the fact of the matter is we need all hands on deck to operate our big boat. But there's another, even more fundamental driver of change, and that is, quite simply, the recognition that it's the right thing to do. So I'd like to thank my co-host Marley Curtis and our guests Anitha De Silva and Katrina Tarker for joining me today, and I look forward to being with you next time for another episode of Roadwork.